God began building the nation of Israel, piece by piece, beginning with Abraham. Because of its sins, God allowed his nation to fall. But later, he would bring his people back together and begin the long process of rebuilding. This is the story of what they did next.
Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the First Christian Church of Perry. Good to see you today. So, this past week, we had Vacation Bible School. 3 nights of loud music and laughing kids and all sorts of fun things. And I had a chance to sort of be there and to help with some of the main lesson, and it was so much fun. One of the things I wanted to mention that I've enjoyed recently is that now that Macon is, you know, going through the different classes and going to school and all, what's funny is that instead of me telling all the Macon stories, people are now starting to tell me Macon stories. Like, this is what he did today and all this or that. And apparently one of the favorite things is that everywhere he goes, he always asks you before he tells you something. He says, "Can I tell you something? Can I tell you something?" And then he'll come up with something really random. He'll be like, "Can I tell you something? Squids have 3 hearts. Thank you for that piece of information. Or, "Can I tell you something? When people eat squid, it's called calamari." And he does it to me too. And so he'll come up with something like that and he'll ask me about it. Be like, "Did you know that platypus has one of only 2 mammal types that lays eggs?" I'll be like, "Yes, son, I did know that, because that's the same book I've read to you every night for the past 3 years, okay? I knew that little factoid that you had." And the other fun thing about VBS is, you know, I showed everyone last week my little detective outfit. I had a blast with that, by the way. And the kids really enjoyed it because they kept coming up to me all the time and talking to me as if I were just, you know, some random person they knew and liked to talk to. And the funniest one, I think, was actually one of Jacob's daughters, one of our youth minister's daughters, because my detective outfit came with a little prop, like smoking pipe, you know, like the old Sherlock Holmes thing. And she looked at me and she said, "You know, if you smoke, you're going to die, right?" Yes, thank you for that little factoid that I was unaware of. But we had a great time, and thank you to all those who helped put it together. It was really fun. So, we have started a new series that we are calling Rebuilding. And we're looking at the nation of Israel after they were exiled in Babylon. And when Cyrus of Persia came to power, he said, "You guys can go back home." But as we pointed out, the process of rebuilding Israel from the ground up was a lengthy one. It took a period of time. And so we're following through the book of Nehemiah to get a sense of that period and how, in fact, God continued to work in them. And so we've been 2 weeks so far. In the first week, we talked about how big things start with a conviction and a prayer. We looked at Nehemiah, who was the cupbearer to the king, lived in the citadel of Susa, quite a ways away from Jerusalem. But he found out about the conditions of things in Jerusalem, and he had an idea, a conviction from God that he could do something about their condition. And then he prayed. And he prayed faithfully over a period of time. He fasted and he sought God's direction. And then last week, in week 2, we talked about how big things continue with patient observation and the gathering of resources. And we looked once again at Nehemiah and how he managed to take his time to pray over the situation. He took a group on horseback and he marched around the city and observed all the places where the wall was weak. Before he ever told anyone what he was planning to do, he'd already surveyed the area. He'd been there more than 3 days. He had taken his time patiently. He'd already asked the king for the resources that were going to be needed to do this job, and he took his time, and then when it was time, he announced his plan to the people. Big things took patient observation and the gathering of resources to know what really needed to be done. And today we're going to continue in this story and this idea of how big things get done. But we're going to do so, we're going to skip chapter 3 just because of the nature of the way it is. It's easier to jump into chapter 4. But we're going to talk about, basically, about having the courage to execute in the face of obstacles. I don't know if you've ever had to face obstacles in your life, but sometimes it takes courage to push through them. Some of those obstacles are not nearly as dramatic as what Nehemiah had to go through. For instance, yesterday I tried installing that new mailbox I had, and it was 100-degree weather, and that was an obstacle, okay? That and my lack of knowledge of how to make things happen. But we pushed through it, and it's there. Jen's laughing because she knows how frustrated I was. But sometimes you've got to push through these obstacles. But in order to kind of give you that idea of how that works with Nehemiah, let's open up to Nehemiah chapter 4 and verse 1. We mentioned this at the very end last week, but there are a couple of key figures coming to the forefront. And these are people who are leaders in the surrounding areas and towns around Jerusalem. And when they see Jerusalem picking back up and building their walls, they see an incoming power and influence in the region that they don't like. And so we get their names and some thoughts about them. Okay, chapter 4, verse 1 begins like this. When Sanballat, that's one of these leaders in the surrounding areas, when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became overjoyed that they were doing such wonderful things, right? No. He became angry and was greatly incensed. I don't use that word often enough, incensed, but I think we should use that. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, he said, "What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" He's not supportive of the cause. Not only that, he's ridiculing, practically making fun of them. Pointing out all the ways in which they aren't really going to be able to finish this. They can't really accomplish this. They're going to fall short. It's too much. And if you think that doesn't make sense, I will say this. A couple of families in our church about a year ago or so went to Jerusalem and walked around and toured the area. And they came back, and one of the things they said so much was, "You wouldn't believe how many rocks there were." Everywhere scattered about. And so I think the gist of this, are they really going to be able to put all these stones back on top of each other and make something out of this? And the part that I really love about this is not only do you have the main guy, Tobiah, but you also have his little partner in crime. I'm sorry, that was Sanballat. Tobiah is the sidekick. And in verse 3, the sidekick jumps in the conversation like he has something important to contribute, and he comes out with a joke. Verse 3, Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What are they building? Even a fox climbing up on it would break down their wall of stones." Thank you for your contribution to this conversation. Why do I even let you talk, you know? He's basically saying, what they're trying to do, they won't accomplish it, and they're doing such a poor job that if a little fox ran up on the wall, it would all crumble, right? Just like my mailbox, as soon as they put the first little bit of mail in there, it's just going to fall to the ground, probably. But he's sitting there and they're teasing him. And they're basically saying, you guys will never get that done. It's the problem of criticism. And in many people's story, it is an obstacle. Have you ever dealt with criticism in your life? Very few people raise their hands. I'm really shocked. Has anyone ever criticized you in your life? Unfortunately, it is an obstacle. Sometimes it's hard to move forward when other people are dragging you back. And this is something that all people have to deal with. And sometimes, when it comes to doing great things, criticism is par for the course. And I'm saying this, it's not always easy. You have to discern these kinds of things. Sometimes it's wise counsel that you shouldn't be ignoring, but sometimes it's just outright criticism. And this is hard. The people in the surrounding areas are just sort of criticizing, and they see an old enemy who might be regaining power and influence. Led by these few key names, they become the primary antagonists to the story. In some way, in some manner, in some form, Nehemiah is going to have to help push them through this criticism of what they're doing. And I will say the very first step of what he does is pretty simple. He prays to God and then he ignores it. We will see here in verse 4. It says, hear us, our God. He goes out in a prayer. He often interrupts the story, the narrative, with a little prayer to God. And he says it like this. Hear us, our God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders. Okay. I recognize that for some of us who are a little soft-hearted, this sounds a little rude. I understand that. A little bit different culture in way back in those days versus today. Nonetheless, I want you to look through that and see that at the base of this is a manner of faith that says, okay, I know people are criticizing me, but God, I give it to you. I leave it off my plate. I don't need to respond. I don't need to figure this out. I don't need to come up with a way to get back at them. Instead, I'm going to offer this to you, ask you to be the God of justice, to work it out in the end, and I'm going to keep focusing on what's ahead. A prayer that's then released and moved on. There is a type of faith to that. It's not that they're saying, God, I want you to destroy them with fire. It's, God, take care of this and let me focus on what I'm doing. And in fact, that's what they do, going down to verse 6. So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height. I don't know how tall the walls were supposed to be, so I'm just sort of randomly throwing my arm out. But they reached it up to half the height it was supposed to be. For the people worked with all their heart. When it comes to overcoming obstacles, like criticism, there is giving it to God and moving on and not feeling the need to respond. There's ignoring it and staying focused. And sometimes there's just old-fashioned determination to keep going. And these people work with all their hearts and they build that wall up to half the height it was supposed to be pretty early in this story. And that's impressive. Nehemiah helped his people through the criticism to focus on the task at hand. He did a good job with it. Now, to try to kind of take this into our own lives, know that there are always things that we have to overcome. There are always obstacles. They're not always people. They're not always criticism, but sometimes they are. For instance, Jen and I. Some of you may know that we met, and we met on, anyone remember? That's right. Wow, good memory. eHarmony. We are a success story so far. We met on eHarmony. I don't know what you said, but I'm going to ignore it. And one of the fun things about that, you know, we were both out of school and we were both, working professional jobs, and it was harder to meet someone, and that for us became a good resource because it gave us a chance to meet people outside of maybe the normal settings and time frame that people meet people. And if you do it right, we felt it could be safe and could be well done. But one of the hardest things was that at that time I lived up close to Noonan where I grew up, and she was working at Georgia Southern. At Georgia Southern, she was working there, which meant we lived what we initially thought was maybe 3 hours away, turned out to be 3.5 and sometimes 4. So you can imagine two people working full-time professional jobs trying to find time to date 4 hours apart from each other. And so there were a lot of weekends where it was like, okay, I'm driving 3.5 hours this week, and you'll drive 3.5 hours next week. And on the first one, I didn't feel like we met in the middle, which I don't know if you know, but when we did the math, the middle came out to be, does anyone know this? Macon, Georgia. Which is, by the way, where we had our first date and where we ultimately named our child. But for us, the distance and living far apart was an obstacle. It was an obstacle to learn about each other. It was hard to know who each other was. I mean, you can only do so much through text messages. I know it's hard to hear that, but you can only do so much through text messages. And, you know, it became something of an obstacle that we had to push through. But because it was something that we felt was worthwhile, our obstacle could be overcome with just some determination and some planning and some grace. By the grace of God, it worked out in wonderful ways. Sometimes your obstacle is more Mother Nature. You know, when we bought this house and I've been trying to work on I'm becoming more and more a yard guy, which I never thought I would be. But my biggest arch nemesis has been the brambles, because they just grow no matter what, you know. You can put poison and poison on them and they just keep coming. It's Mother Nature fighting against me, like the classic stories of old. But I'm going to win this battle through old-fashioned determination. But sometimes your obstacle is, in fact, criticism, just like it was in Nehemiah. I'll say this. One of the things I have had to learn as I've been in the ministry now 9 years full-time, as full-time senior minister, I should say, 9 years, I've learned that criticism occasionally becomes part of the job. I don't know if you know that, but when people, you know, try to lead things in the church, you occasionally get little tidbits. And I've been fortunate. I'm not, you know, I don't expect myself to be immune to what other people do. And I haven't had that much. But occasionally, we do have to deal with little things here and there, little criticisms. And I've had to learn how to be okay with that. But to keep our eyes on the prize of what's in front of us, to not let that get us down, to focus on what really is. And one of the ways that I like to tell people, and I got this from another minister before me, but he told me this one time, and it really stood out to me, and it especially regards criticisms. He said, when it comes to criticism, treat it like bubble gum. Chew, but don't swallow. Does that make sense? Someone has something negative to say about what you're doing, it might be okay to chew on that for a minute and figure out whether or not there's any validity to what they said. Maybe they've got a good point. Maybe they're seeing something you hadn't seen. Maybe I ought to chew on this and at least consider what they're thinking. But should I swallow it? Probably not. The counterpoint to this is that what applies to criticism also applies to compliments. So when you do something really well and everyone comes up and congratulates you, you chew on it a little bit, you appreciate it, but you never swallow it. Otherwise, you start to think more of yourself than you ought to. So the obstacles you overcome, be it criticism, be it Mother Nature, be it distance, be it whatever it is, all of us have to overcome those things, sometimes with sheer determination. Now, in this case, in the case of Nehemiah, the criticism and the ignoring of criticism no longer becomes tenable. It becomes beyond that. And if you read this chapter, you sort of discover that. So I'm jumping down to verse 7 now. It says, "But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the people of Ashdod..." Now, how many... he had two guys criticizing him, and now how many people does he have working against him? A bunch. "When all those people heard that the repairs of Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were overjoyed at the success of their fellow peers." No. They were angry, and they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to stir up trouble against it. So what started out as criticisms, now that they've gotten halfway up, they didn't think they'd ever get this far, now is brought into action. And now they're going to have to do more than simply say a prayer and release it. Keep going. "But we pray to our God," so he does begin with prayer, as he does almost everything in this book, "and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Meanwhile," so there's more, they post a guard. "Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, 'The strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall.' So on one hand, you have a credible threat from a growing alliance against you. Number two, your own people are getting weary and scared and growing, depressed, discouraged." Yes, that's not a big word. I could not come up with discouraged. You guys pray for me. Okay. They're getting discouraged. There's so much left to be done and so many people coming against them. Go just a little bit further here. "Also, our enemies said, 'Before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them and will kill them and put an end to the work.'" Credible threat to violence. Verse 12, "Then the Jews," that is people on their side, "who live near them, came and told us 10 times over, 'Wherever you turn, they will attack us.'" So not only is there a seeming credible threat, there's a real credible threat being told to you by your own people. So, right, number one, coalition forming with a real threat of violence. Two, people of Judah growing weary, afraid, and discouraged. Make sure I got that word. And number three, a growing paranoia and reports of secret plans. This is not something that they're going to be able to ignore and give it to God. At this point, they need a leader. They need someone to help keep the project on track, keep the people on task, unite them, and form a plan to keep moving ahead. And the first thing I want to say that they do is they figure out how to come together and overcome this. Because I think this is important. Not only do they make a plan to work together, but they slow down. Keep reading verses 13 through 15. "Therefore," and this is Nehemiah speaking, "I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, 'Don't be afraid of them.'" Keep going. "Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. And when our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot, that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to our own work." Okay, let me back up. I kind of got a little bit ahead of myself. So the first thing he does is he gets the people together. He reminds them that God is in charge. He posts them at the most important places where the wall was low. And essentially, if I'm reading this correctly, he's showing the surrounding peoples, "Hey, we know about your plan, and we're ready to meet it. We know about your plan, and we're ready to meet it." And it showed them that that was the case. He also prayed to God and reminded them who was really in charge. He is a leader giving them a goal. And what's cool about this is even though they stopped the work for a minute, it would appear, and showed them that they were ready to meet the plot, it caused the people of the surrounding areas to take a step back, realizing they'd been caught, and then at the end, they got back to work. He stopped the initial threat, stopped the bleeding, gave the people confidence, and let them get back to work for a moment. Of course, this wasn't the end of it, because the threats continue to come. Verse 16. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. That's some organization, right? Division of labor. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah who were building the wall, and those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. I have no idea how you build a wall with one hand, but they found a way to do it, right? And this is something pretty incredible. And each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked, but the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me. There's a division of labor here. You've got people who are working, you've got people who are protecting, you've got people who are working and protecting, or at least have the option by their side. You've got a trumpeter overlooking and making sure no one is coming, and he has found a way to divide the people to keep the work going. And undoubtedly, to me, it would have to slow down. If you're holding a sword and half your people are doing security, then probably the progress got a little bit slower. But guess what? They still made progress. And that was the only way to make things work. Sometimes I think we have to be okay with progress. We have to be okay with maybe being a little bit slower, dividing the labor, doing things in a way that keeps us safe. There are some people who come into a church and they get so gung-ho and they want things to change and grow and progress and get bigger, and they do so. And all of that is well-meaning. But when things in churches move slower than they're used to, they get frustrated. But the church is made up of volunteers. It's a community. We don't hire and fire and meet goals by a certain deadline. We move as a people, as an organism. And sometimes making progress is all we can do, and to do consistently. And I think that he does a good job of bringing them together, making sure the work continues, and being satisfied with what progress can be made considering these moments. And you notice the people have to be following with all their heart in order to do these things. We'll keep going a little bit further. Verse 19, he gives them a little bit further instructions. Then I said to the nobles, the officials, the rest of the people, the work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. That is a vulnerability, by the way. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us. So one of the fears, one of the worries is that when they are all working spread out along this entire wall surrounding the city, that creates a lot of gaps and makes it impossible for any one group to be able to defend an entire army. And so through the ways of thinking and the strategies of the time, they have to come up with a way of making sure one group doesn't get overwhelmed during an attack. And the problem is that of communication. How do you let people know what's going on where they can't see? And so they make a plan that this trumpet will then announce that an attack is taking place in this area, and when that happens, all people are to come here. What that means is they are now able to protect their vulnerabilities. But what I find about this are two things. One, it's unifying because they're all part of this battle. They're all together in the same thing. They're not like, well, they didn't get into my section of the wall. Oh, well. They work together on it. They're unified in it. And two, they're communicating with one another, which, by the way, as an aspect of leadership and accomplishing great things, communication is pretty key. If you don't tell people what you're doing or why you're doing it or how you're doing it or what you need, things don't happen. Communication, setting a vision, explaining the why, and explaining the how has everything to do with accomplishing big things. And Nehemiah, as the leader, understands that and makes sure that these things happen. I find all this interesting. This is a fascinating way of making sure this gets done and that they overcome the obstacles around them. Okay, one more section. Let's go to verse 21 and 22. He continues on with how this becomes something that is all day, every day. verse 21, "So we continued the work with half of the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out." What does that mean? All daylight, all day. "At that time, I also said to the people, have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night so they can serve us as guards by night and workers by day." In other words, a lot of the workers are commuting to Jerusalem from the surrounding areas, and they would like to go home at night when they get done with their work, but his instructions are what? Don't go home, stay here. We'll do you half as security and half as a builder. And I'm wondering, when did anyone sleep? I don't know the answer to that. It's a Bible mystery that we're just going to have to ask when we get to heaven. But the important matter is this: where this began and where this ends is really just a matter of old-fashioned determination. Once you've made the plan and executed it, sometimes you just got to push through it until it gets done. And a lot of big things take that kind of endurance. And the presence of obstacles doesn't mean that God isn't on your side. In fact, it's just part of your progress in the faith that you figure out this thing of work ethic, and you see it through. Right or wrong, I'm going to go ahead and go down one more line of thought. One of the things that has always bothered me about the way churches work, because church is kind of a voluntary thing, and for many people, a bit of an extracurricular thing, it often becomes the first thing that's dropped. And so when I compare it to the kinds of things in which I learned work ethic as a child, it just doesn't come very close. So, for instance, I was, for all those years, a wrestler. And wrestlers are famous for just really being kind of crazy. I had all these guys that just, they put on the trash bags and turned the heat up to 90 and ran around till they lost 10 pounds in sweat. And you weigh in right before at the lowest weight you're going to hit, and then you go have breakfast, and by the time you actually wrestle, you're 5 pounds heavier. There were guys who, they swore, if in the weigh-in room, they swore if you stood on your head for about 30 seconds and then flipped right over while your blood was falling to the bottom, you could lose another 3 ounces. Now, can you imagine a bunch of guys in their underwear standing on their heads before jumping onto a scale? They were crazy. I don't think we ever got home before dark. Some practices didn't end until someone was bleeding. This is just, we were taught work ethic through the tradition of sports. And then, of course, you get older and you get taught it in, hey, son, go mow this lawn. No, you didn't do it right. Do it again. And no, you still didn't do it right. Do it one more time. You know, you get taught that work ethic through these different things. But now take that whole mindset and move it over to the church, and what do you get? I'm sorry, I don't know if this is right to say, but I'm going to say it. It's drizzling. Let's stay home today. You know what? We were out a little bit late the night before. Let's just not do it today. Or I really can't add one more thing to my schedule because we go out to eat after church and we can't stay around any longer. And again, I'm not trying to critique, because we have wonderful volunteers, and I appreciate those who do such amazing things, but there is something about the category of work ethic in sports or in other areas of life versus the category of work ethic in the church that tells me that old-fashioned determination just doesn't apply to one of those sometimes. And I feel like we have to work through that somewhat. My point being is that no matter what you're doing in life, there are always obstacles. Nehemiah faced obstacles in the form of people who were ready to pull out swords and fight against what was happening. But in the end, they found their way to push through it so that those big things that began as a conviction in his heart could ultimately end in the glorification of God in the city of Jerusalem. And that is ultimately what his story is about. I have tried through this series to bring in certain things we've dealt with as a church, just to try to see what we are doing as part of our own journey, of our own obstacles and things. And you know, I don't want to overly spiritualize things that we go through. But at the same time, there are always obstacles in any church. Ours have largely been about the building. Since I've been here, how many air conditioners have we replaced? Lee, do you know? Because Alan might know better. Six, maybe, since I've been here. We put on a new roof. We had a water main burst in the middle of our parking lot. We've done mold remediation. We are working on trying to pave that parking lot. We had an entire fire system update, particularly in the other building. Every time it rains or has any lightning anywhere in a 10-mile radius, we have fried electronics when we get here. And more. And these are just the silly little things that come up. And I can't even complain because these are ordinary things. But they feel like obstacles sometimes when you're trying to accomplish something. More to the point, some of the obstacles we've overcome are just matters of the timing of things, like trying to return to full programming after COVID happened, and we didn't know who was in the church, and we didn't know who would want to lead these different things, and we had all these gaps, and it took us a while to fill them in. Because to bring any program back, you need volunteers, you need excitement, you need a plan, and you need an opportunity to do it. And one by one, we have brought back programs that need to be brought back and brought in new ones that needed to be become part of what we do. And the last thing that I want to do today is I want to set a little bit of a vision for the fall again. Something I've talked about a couple weeks ago, that we are in the middle of summer, but in the middle of fall, everyone comes back to school. That's what I really want to be ready for. One of the things we're doing is that that conference there, August 4th through 7th. That'll be a really fascinating thing. But right after that, I want to make you aware of a plan that we've been working through as staff to revamp our Wednesday nights. Some of the things we've been thinking about, one of the problems we've had, well, for a long time, was we didn't have food for people, right? We used to do meals a long time ago, and that became harder during COVID and some other things going on. But then we had people step in, and now we have meals every week. Praise God. We had trouble getting people to watch the children, and we've had a couple of ladies step up who've done a fantastic job with that, and the kids have a great time in there every week. We have struggled to find anyone to start the nursery again, which is hard because there are some new families in the church that I would love to come to class on Wednesday but can't because they don't have any nursery care. So here's what I have been talking with people about and trying to get started. This past fall, I started a little growth group at my house. I think it was every other Monday or something like that. And I specifically brought in a lot of the people who are somewhat new to our church and trying to get involved. And through proof of concept, I found that there was interest. And I found that people could make it on a fairly regular basis on Monday nights at my house. So I had a conversation with them about the possibility of sort of taking what we do there and also doing it on Wednesday, so that we would have a revamped Wednesday night. We could take advantage of the childcare being provided. We could use people in that class and anyone who wants to help to keep the nursery going, so that there would be activities and things to do for every age. Finally, every part would be filled out. There'd be food, childcare, nursery, and no one would have an excuse not to come on Wednesday nights. And by the grace of God, I think it's happening. I've got a couple other teachers to help me out so we could have two classes going, perhaps, and we could keep some of my growth group together and some of the people who love their group now together, but mostly you'd have two classes offered. And I've got some other teachers. My growth group agreed to help run a nursery on rotational basis. I feel that Wednesday night programming can be revamped and made important. And so I want you guys to keep that in mind, because I'm excited about that. The truth be told is we need more than just Sunday morning. I do my best to put the Bible together in a way that's understandable on Sunday morning. But there's something special about getting in a group of people and talking about what you read. There's an ability to go further in depth. There's an ability to go verse by verse through smaller sections. There's an ability to share what's going on in your life and to hear the wisdom of others who are going through similar things or have already gone through them. I can tell you right now, talk to anyone who comes to our Wednesday night class, and they will tell you how special that time is. I really believe that. I enjoy that time. I think that it is refreshing to me. And sometimes I so wish others in the church knew about that or experienced that, because I think it would mean so much to them. And so my goal this fall is to revamp Wednesday nights, and I really want you guys to pray about that. I know that Wednesdays during the school year are hard. Trust me, I had a kid in T-ball. I understand how that gets, and I know that it's not easy. However, I think more of us can make it than we've let on. There will already be food there. There will already be childcare. There's no excuse not to try it. So please, pray about this fall making your church schedule twice a week. Once for a sermon-type situation on Sundays, and once for a lesson that you can talk over with other people. I believe it could be a blessing and help us get to greater depths in our spirituality and in finding what God has called us to do. I really believe it's that important. We need it for the prayer. We need it for the Bible study. We need it for the fellowship, because there's only so much we can do on 1 hour a week. So here are my application points. Number one, I said this before, but I'll just remind you quickly. When it comes to criticisms and even compliments, chew on them, but don't swallow them. Take time to consider it, but don't let it throw you off course. Number two, consider overcoming obstacles as part of our spiritual growth. It doesn't mean that God isn't with us. Many times it means we need to continue to push through. And number three, plan to attend Wednesday services in the fall. I'm excited to see how this goes. If it doesn't work, oh well, no harm. But I think I'd like to try it. And so I ask you guys to pray over it. Now, if you will, let's finish with prayer and we will keep going. God, I thank you for a chance to look at your words. I pray that you continue to be present in the things that we do. I thank you, Lord, that you continue to work with people to accomplish your goals. And I pray that you continue to work in this church and this community. And I thank you, and I'm humbled that we should ever have that chance. Help us today that when we get criticism, to not be discouraged, but when we get wise counsel, to recognize the difference. Help us, Lord, to be faithful to your cause, to push forward with what you would have us do, that you, Lord, may be honored in the end. And it's in your Son's precious holy name we pray. Amen.